And welcome back to the Batuta Advocate podcast. This is part two of our thrilling interview with Tim Ross, talking about Australian architecture, Australian design, and what it looks like moving forward and what it has looked like over the years past. First episode was quite a stimulating discussion. It was such a big yarn that we actually had to split this up into 2 weeks. So sit back and enjoy part two.
You're listening to Errol Parker and Clancy Overall, editors of the Batuta Advocate on Desert Rock FM.
If you could pick all this apart and look at one vein, do we have a uniquely Australian design? Do we have a uniquely Australian brand of architecture? And if so, tell me what it looks like.
Oh, there's plenty of them. But I mean, in the most obvious way is those, the one that the world has responded to is the Glenn Murcutt. Idea of a, you know, the tin shed,
yeah,
but
like the plantation chic,
but the so he just sort of took the tin shed and that materiality. But the one I really love, and it's sort of out of fashion, but so there's I was talking about him before, you know, this guy Michael Dysart,
yeah,
and he's a wonderful, I'm such a fan of his work, and he designed the first demountable,
yeah,
the most
public schools love him,
the most underrated piece of Australian architecture going around.
Yeah.
Completely practical. The reason we still need them today is the reason we needed them back in the 1960s, mm-hmm. is that we don't know how many kids are going to turn up on day one.
Yeah.
So basically in the 1960s, they added an extra year of school.
Yep.
And they went, oh, where are we going to put all these kids? Plus we've got a baby boom going on.
Yeah.
And so he just goes, all right, we're going to design a room that we can put on the back of the truck. And they are beautiful in their own way. Yeah, they were hot and cold, but so was your bedroom when you were a kid. But Michael went out to look at Elizabeth Farm in Parramatta, and they were just knocking everything over in the 1960s. And so they work with the Housing Trust, the National Trust, to hold on to this building. And it's a classic house, you know, pioneer homestead-style house with a veranda.
Yeah.
And very much perfect for this climate. And Michael in 1971 or something like that, creates a modernist version of that as a project home for all Australians. And they are beautiful and people really like them. And then they get copied. So when by the 1980s, you see them all the time because there's this sense of we're looking back, colonial style, history's big, the rise of the bicentenary. And then by the time it gets to the early 90s, that style of sort of faux colonial buildings are still really popular, but they've got none of the design intent that he had. So we lose all of that stuff and everything becomes about the fashion. So I think those styles of buildings are remarkably us, but anything that we see that responds to climate, and we will see that everywhere. And I think that's this sort of wonderful leap forward that we're seeing in our domestic architecture, despite housing unaffordability, is that we will continue to see great architects do great things. We've got beautiful light, we've got beautiful climate, and for the moment, we've still got more space than anyone else really to do these things. And the sadness is that not more people can have that dream of being able to hook into this.
But maybe this is the reset, you know? Like, you know, if we are looking at a Albanese housing fund, if we are looking at all these things, it's clear we need to build more houses, and maybe it is time for some sort of a template.
Yeah, I think that architects too, especially in this country, get kind of lumped in with being, you know, less practical people and more like on the artistry side of things.
Yeah, but I think the
bonus.
You do. So, I mean, I love this, right? So you've all been in a terrace house.
Yeah.
Right. And now I call them like they're like the cockroach of Australian design. They're indestructible.
Yeah.
And we will accept them in all sorts of ways. You know, we've all been in one that's been a Italian restaurant, a Thai restaurant, a dentist.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, in some places they're brothels. You know, and so they've been used in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Then they still really work because of the density. Yeah. Like you can put a lot of people in a short period of time. They've got heaps of privacy. And so they can adapt. In those early houses, you know, people wouldn't go past the first bedroom. And that first bedroom wasn't a bedroom. It was a dining room. No one ever lived in those front bedrooms. So they've adapted over time in different ways.
So your guests would just pull in there. That was it.
You wouldn't go past. You often see in any of those houses, even the Queenslanders, there's like a decorative sort of frame in the hallway. And that was sort of signifying where you could go. You couldn't go any further than that. People would rarely use a bathroom at a friend's place. And that would be it. You would go into the front room and that was it. So they have adapted in time and use that. So the next real challenge for our existing housing stock, because this is truly the answer for affordability, is how do we take the houses that were there in the suburbs without knocking them over and then adapt them to a new way of living, which is what I was talking about with before, which is this sort of multi-generational homes or splitting existing housing stock into two houses or three houses. Mm-hmm. And that's where design's important, because you can put a kitchen in with, you know, about the size of an upright piano.
Yeah.
That's all you really need. And so for one or two people. So that's where the governments need to get on board. And they do it all the time, right? They call it the missing middle. And the missing middle is this idea of how infill. They talk about it a lot in Perth, because in Perth it's more of an issue because you can't keep expanding forever because they don't have the money to put new schools in it and they won't put new train lines in.
Yeah.
So you go, we've got to make the most of where
we are.
Where we are. And so there's a huge backyard there. And the answer isn't just knocking things over and putting apartments in. It's saying, how do we put three houses here really beautifully and keep that house that's at the front, or split this existing house
in
half?
Like terrace houses, yeah.
And so, you know, when you go to, over the years, everyone would have visited some apartment in the inner city that was once a mansion that was turned into 16 apartments.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen with McMansions. Yeah. They're going to have to be carved up into individual apartments in the suburbs.
Yeah.
But sadly enough, I think they'll all get knocked over. And the evolution of how the McMansion becomes a much more interesting building in the future is a fascinating one, because they will be adapted.
In preparation for this interview, I was doing a bit of reading about architecture and repurposing things like this. And I was reading about there's this architecture firm in Canberra that's turning all the old sort of gubbies. And instead of tearing down these houses, they're turning these gubbies into like houses which have like a passive design with them, like they make them airtight like that. So rather than tearing down all what Canberra is, which was essentially how you can build the fastest amount of houses very quickly, but they look nice from space.
Yeah.
But like,
but that's, yeah, they're really interesting because it's a science-based approach to architecture, which is saying, well, then we need to make our houses far more sustainable. And the most, you know, when they talk about 7-star buildings, you know, oh my God, the most sustainable building is a building you keep.
Yep.
Because once you knock over a building and then you build something with concrete, it's like, whoa. That's the sadness of it. You know, 30-year-old building, get rid of that one, knock it down, start again.
Does it ever blow your mind? Does it ever blow your mind that people that are involved in this game, construction or whatever, or hospitality? I'll always remember one moment. There was an old pub near the cross called the Tradesman's Arms. Tilly Devine used to drink there, iconic Sydney pub. Got bought out. I won't say the name of the new owners because they're still in operation, but I popped my head in one day when they were revamping it, and I saw them taking a jackhammer to the jade tiles on the wall of the pub. I remember thinking, at least 20 people have been involved in this decision.
Mm.
Like, you're not getting that back. You're not getting those tiles, like the old pub tiles that, you know, Tilly Devine used to sit up in front of when she was running 12 knock shops up the street. That's a very historical erasure I've just witnessed there. That blew my mind. Does it ever blow your mind when you're meeting people who are like, you know, we just pull this fucking thing down?
All the constantly. And the argument is that, yeah, well, you're talking about tiles that were put in there because the 6 o'clock swill, because people would just piss at the bar because
they replaced it with the like that Tasmania industrial chic, just concrete look.
You know, we've all worked in a business, or most of us have, in a place where, you know, there's someone in the office who's in charge of buying furniture and they always buy shit furniture.
Yeah.
And the person always in charge is, you know, you got to put the signs up on the fridge and all that shit. And that just happens on a larger scale when it comes to
And that. People are some usually taking it upon themselves too, which I guess is where a lot of the
And you start saying, oh, okay, because why does it matter? Well, because once that one goes and then the next one goes and the next one goes, and it normalizes everything until you turn around and it's, you know, that's what's happened on the Gold Coast.
Yeah.
Like the Gold Coast is the gold star when it comes to what happens when you do whatever you want.
Yeah.
And in the smallest period of time, like we're talking about 70 years of taking one of the most beautiful places in the country and changing it into something that is still got a beautiful beach, but it's extraordinary what they did there. Like in the 1960s, you would, like, you see those photos and they go, oh, we put in, there's four motels and there's one high rise, and there's no one who lives within 2 kilometres of them.
Yeah.
And then you look at it today and you go, that's the future in front of us if we don't
Does the Gold Coast have a look? Is there a textbook Gold Coast look? I don't know.
I mean, you made so many different types of high-rise, but, you know, the story of those motels, mad. Like, there's these guys, and let's talk about isolation of this country, right? So in the 1950s, there's a whole bunch of them, and they go to America, and they take photos of motels, and they come back with their little box brownies, and then they give the photos to their builders and say, can you build me one of those? And they're all out of whack. They're all out of scale. And that's how they ended up. And now Bernie Elsie was the guy who pretty much created the Gold Coast. He was the one who talked Ansett into putting the flights in. He created the meter maids later on.
Yeah. And he had the bolo tie.
Yeah.
I think he ended up in the Fitzgerald Inquiry. But they all
yeah,
did.
Of course. But he was really smart. He had the two beachcombers. And he saw that Princess Margaret was going to these pajama parties. He saw that in the news. He went, I'm going to have these in my motel. And so they'd all wear their pajamas in, and then they'd all end up in the pool, and you couldn't drink after a certain time. And so they always have a band playing, and then the cops would turn up, and everyone would chuck the beers in the pool so they wouldn't get arrested. And the cops used to take off their clothes to jump in the pool to get the beers, and the band used to play the stripper music every time they did it. It happened every night. And then Bernie worked out that he changed it from pajama parties where everyone could bring their own clothes to a Hawaiian party where you'd wear a lei, and then he'd rent them to them for $2. And then if you went in the pool, it was ruined and you had to pay $5. So it was huge. But his golden streak ran out in 1964. But he booked the Beatles to play on their famous tour. And then he read the contract and realized he had to put them up for the night and feed them. And he was such a tight ass. He went, I'm not
canned.
Yeah, he canned it. Yeah.
Fuck.
But they wouldn't have been too fussy.
They wouldn't have cared.
Like, I just want some chips. Yeah. No, I'll have some fish. Have you got it, man?
So was that where that would have been the Maori show band era? That was the big thing we learned from H.G. Nelson when he did his Secret Cities. Every hotel had a Maori show band with 10 people playing.
Yeah.
And they'd all rotate, someone would go get a feed, then they'd get back up there.
It's just extraordinary. And like, then the next level is that they were sort of these Americana style motels came along.
Mm-hmm. Big and sign then, up the front.
Yeah, and then by the 1980s, most of them were gone. And, you know, they keep a few signs, and there's some of them are still left, but, you know, that's progress.
The Gold Coast is just the Australian Emirates. I mean, it's our Dubai.
We need the line. We need a big line.
Oh, man.
Australia's Emirates. Well, just quickly, I mean, the motels, I'm going to go back and look at your motel series, but let's talk about designing a legacy. Mm. What sparked you on this particular journey?
This is the second one I've done, third series for the ABC, and the second one, Designing a Legacy, was mostly about domestic architecture and these wonderful stories about people who've grown up in amazing houses and some people, you know, they think, oh, shivers, what I'm doing, we love this house but we don't want it to get knocked over. What are we going to do with mum or dad's house or our house? Some people gave them away. Some people bought back their family home. Some of them have been bequeathed. And so it's just about connecting the stories of architecture with people. Mm-hmm. And this one takes a broader look at that. How important our landscape is in the first one, and how important connecting to landscape is to us. Also, how our buildings need to tell a different story. They've always told the one story. And that's been really, really great to unpack in a TV point of view, talk about designing for country and facing up to their buildings need to represent an Indigenous history and connect mm-hmm. with country. So that was really fulfilling. And then tackling some of these ideas about housing affordability and housing models and social housing.
Okay.
And
so we weren't just coming on with a long run up at the start of this. This is, you know.
No,
we've
talked about all of it. Yeah. No, like I think the social housing thing is particularly important to me. I was pretty heavily involved in Sydney for the Save the Sirius building.
Yeah. Runway Jesus.
And that was this beautiful brutalist building and that's been people's homes in the rocks. And the government basically, you know, they sold it for $70 million. Oh, no, come on, I can't. You'd have to fact check. Maybe it was $150 million. Mm. There's a considerable difference. I can't remember. But, you know, they sold it for not enough money.
Yep.
And then the developers sold the penthouse for $35
million. 150 rocks it sold for.
150, they sold the penthouse for 35, right? So, yeah. So there's 79 apartments and they didn't even sell them for $2 million each.
No.
The government's just fire-saling our assets.
Yeah.
And what happened was, it's like we're involved in this campaign. There's a whole bunch of us. There's architects, there's some politicians.
The honor on the roof.
There's the social housing tenants and there's a real ragtag of us. And, you know, we're all passionate about it for varying different reasons. Some, you know, more about the architecture, some more about social housing. And I sort of started in the camp where I wanted to save this building that I always thought was amazing. And then I realized what's really important is the social housing element. One of the things I did was that I realized that we had to change people's perception of it and we needed to do a marketing campaign for the building. And so we made it super Instagram friendly. So people were taking lots of photos of it. And then we created this thing called Friday Night Sirius, which was instead of having a drink at the pub, bring all your mates down to Sirius. We'll put on some beers and some sausages. So we started having, you know, there'd be 300-400 people who turn up on a Friday and have beers around this place. And I wanted to bring people in who had never been to it because everyone, oh, it's brutalist, it's ugly. And I said, come up and feel it, touch it.
Yeah.
Get your head around it. We'll talk to you about why it's important. And so that was working really well. And my desire was to make it non-political. So there was no speeches because when we did the demonstrations, but if you're conservative governments, and still, as soon as you march, they don't care.
And it was under Baird too. Like, you know, he was shutting down greyhound racing. He wasn't giving a fuck about anything.
There was, you could pretty much say that if you were, that wasn't going to change anyone's mind. Yeah. So we did this thing and we had all the people and this is public space. And then I think after the third or fourth one, they put the cyclone fence around the building to stop us from gathering there.
Right.
It's a real act of bastardry. And the other thing I got this mate, Pete Chadwick, who did this brutalism book in the UK, really great graphic designer, and he did like all these amazing albums like Groovemata, the Screamadelica, Primal Screen. And so he made these great posters. And so we put a little bit of money that we'd done from some fundraising into laying these posters all over Sydney, sort of making this building iconic. And so we get to the stage, the government sell it. The major reason the developer didn't knock it over was that if he knocked it over, he couldn't build it up as high again.
Right.
That was one of the quirks of planning. But the advertising campaign that he did, and there's these wraparounds on the front page of the Oz and all that sort of stuff, talked about this serious social housing building being iconic piece of architecture.
Yeah.
So in the process of trying to save the building,
we've
made it iconic and we've made him millions and millions of dollars.
You've made him richer.
So
is it like
it was sold for $150 million by the Berejiklian government and it resulted for the developer $435 million worth of sales.
Yeah.
But at least people appreciate brutalism.
Yeah. And so you can live there and go, this is a brutalist building, you know. Yeah. So
what I loved about that building was when they were holding strong and the last tenants were refusing to be thrown out. I think one of the last ones was this old nonna on the roof who was blind.
Yeah.
And all the property, like, it blew their mind. All these property pigs are like, she can't even see the view. I was saying, I was hoping she'd stay on as long as possible. Did you feel any?
Maya, she was beautiful.
Did you feel any dirty tactics from the? Did you get any late night phone calls? Because it gets to that point.
When we took them to court, I can't remember exactly what it was. I wasn't deeply involved in the legal challenging the heritage minister Mark Speakman at the time. They loved coming personal about it. Perrottet. What do you call it? You're like, well, it's just, you know, this group, you know, B-grade architect and a former radio DJ. And I was like, oh, well, at least they're taking notice. In terms of messaging and how we knew it worked was he started off, you know, he did this editorial in The Telegraph and it was like, it's about as sexy as a car park. And then he ended up saying, actually, from some angles, I suppose it can be attractive. Because we did this thing. I love this one. So during Vivid, some of the guys from one of the young kids from one of the architecture firms had been working on saving it. They went down to a hire place and they hired some lights And so we lit it up and made it look like it was part of Vivid.
Yeah.
And so everyone was taking photos of it. And that made the government spare as well because, you know, that Vivid is their baby. Yeah. They control it.
Yeah.
And then what the fuck's that? There it is with these all these lights and all these kids stopping and taking photos.
Harbour Bridge is people pulling. Yeah.
So that stuff was cool. But, yeah, I think the sadness is that when you're coming back to that point, it's, you know, what did Maya – she couldn't even see the view, and then suddenly that becomes – there was a constant thing that would turn up on Facebook. Why don't I get a harbour view?
Yeah.
So what changed with us when we cared about where people lived in the mid-1970s and to the point where we suddenly didn't give a shit? Or more to the point, the reason – they sold out the whole of the Rocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
The terrace houses, the whole lot.
I remember the sign.
It's a whole suburb.
New South Wales property and Ray White on the same sign out front of the flats.
A whole suburb where people had lived for over 100 years, community disappeared, moved out completely, and turned into an Airbnb suburb where no one lives. You can park there all the time because there's no one ever there.
Yeah.
But this is the most fascinating thing about it. Like, the reason it existed and why it worked so well was that they built all those houses so people who worked at the docks could be close to their family.
Yeah.
They were doing that 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And now we're struggling to do the same with our teachers. And
Like
we were better at it then.
It is, yeah. I mean, the Woolloomooloo is the same. The Green Band, you talk about all that kind of stuff. And once upon a time, the trade unions would turn up for something like this. Maybe they will now.
The Green Bands on that building is the reason that they started to demolish the Rocks.
Yeah.
And there was that. They demolished where Sirius was. And Jack Mundy came along and he led that movement. Mm. And he was an extraordinary man.
He was also the man that made sure they didn't put a car park out the back of the Opera House. He made them go underground. Yeah.
And for good, I think.
if there was a fucking car park but they tried the back of the Opera House.
Yeah.
Well, it could have, and it wouldn't surprise if they did, you know. And
Jack Mundy's from fucking Cairns.
Yeah.
Like there was this – Jack would have been in his, I don't know, maybe early 80s when we were doing the campaign. And I was on stage hosting this – one of these events. Maybe it was the demo. I can't remember. But anyway, someone said, oh, I don't know whether Jack's going to speak or not. And I said, are you going to speak, Jack? And he goes, oh, I don't know. And he was like pretty frail. And then he said, oh, okay, I'll speak. And he frailly got up the steps and got in front of the mic. And then he opened up his mouth, and it was the most glorious thing I'd ever seen.
Castro.
Unbelievable. Like, you know, just in that old school way that people can talk and corral a crowd and control a crowd. He was magnificent.
Yeah. Well, in the Albanese government, the Albanese government's led by Anthony Albanese, we just spent best part of 10, 20 minutes talking about the Rocks. Albanese's mentor was a bloke, a war veteran, former Golden Glove boxer turned public housing defender and advocate, Tommy Uren. So if you are listening to this, Albanese, and I know your staffers are, just remember that. Just remember that when we start talking about these housing funds and social housing. I wonder what Tom Uren would say about what happened to the Rocks in the last 10 years. Well, people sat on their hands, of course. Everyone except today's guest, Tim Ross. Thank you for joining us.
To be fair, to Elbow was down there for the fight for Sirius.
Oh, he's got a bit more power now. Yeah.
but he was there. He was there in opposition.
It's owned by the state government, so he can't do anything.
The
Labor Party was not in power, so it's like...
He was the shadow minister for...
I can't remember what he was, but he was there. He turned up a lot.
Aside from doing what the IRA did, I mean, there probably wasn't too much that the Labor Party could do in that respect there.
I will say this about... There's a guy who worked on my TV show for the ABC, right? Amir. He's a refugee, and his family's still in a refugee camp, and he doesn't have a passport. So he can... work on our show. He's making the most beautiful shows for the ABC.
Oh, he can't go.
Can't go anywhere.
Amir.
So, like, you know, he's electricity in. Tanya Plibersek.
Tanya.
Mm.
Sydney City. Mm. Well, Tanya.
As Environment Minister. Yeah.
Tap on the shoulder to our Home Affairs Minister. And Amir, is it?
Yeah, Amir.
Let him stay, goddamn.
He's allowed to stay.
Just give him a fucking passport.
Oh, so let him leave momentarily.
No, we'll just get
like he hasn't even been to Bali yet.
He's still in limbo.
Oh, right. Purgatory. Well.
Thanks, gentlemen.
I thought I landed a punch on Albanese there, but you guys rushed to his defence.
Yeah.
Just stating facts.
That's literally like. Here's to a future of cooperative
housing, yeah.
Cooperative housing.
Intergenerational, can't get rid of your parents type house.
Oh, you can get rid of them.
They just moved
in the granny flat.
They moved to the granny flat, and then
no, you move them into a home, and you rent out the granny flat, and then you can travel
just
overseas.
Some international I put 18 kids in here from fucking overseas, and then
when the grandparents get moved into a home, that's when the teenager moves into the granny flat to rip cones.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this is an Australian passage, so rite of passage. Thank you for joining us today, Tim.
Pleasure, gents.
Thanks, mate.